Blog Talk Radio.
Son of a bitch. What's up, people? Oh, it is healthcare day. It is healthcare day all day long, baby. Man, I think you know what the big story of the day is, like I just told you. I think roughly at least half the stories are going to be on healthcare, for obvious reasons. And the House of Representatives decided to stab the American people in the back. There's really no reason to sugarcoat it. Obamacare is already a weak right-wing bill, and they decided, out of spite, to repeal their own original proposal and replace it with what is, I'm not joking when I say, an amalgamation of right-wing talking points that you'd probably hear on talk radio. So, if this thing actually gets through the Senate, which at the moment doesn't look likely, but if it were to somehow get through the Senate, good googly-moogly, would we be in for quite a collapse of the American healthcare system. I mean, it's already, in tatters, and it still, we'd get to the point where it would be even more disastrous and even more grotesque. But outside of healthcare, what I have for you today, I have an interesting ad about how ISIS apparently has invaded suburbia and they're now robbing people. Oh, there's a Republican politician who released an ad that basically has that in it. And it is one of the saddest ads I think I've ever seen. We also have, I wanted to get to this yesterday, but I didn't have time. It was, I guess this is related to healthcare too, but you have a right-wing publication responded to Jimmy Kimmel and his heartfelt, call for healthcare for, low-income people. And their response just shows there's no, there's not even a political ideology that some on the far right have. It's just, it's a reflexive fuck you to anything that would move us in the right direction. So let's go ahead and get started here. And we're going to start with all the details of TrumpCare 3.0. And then I'll give you the responses, what the fallout is, and all that. All right, let's do it. The House of Representatives actually succeeded in passing TrumpCare 3.0 yesterday. Of course, the first iteration of the bill failed. The second one, I don't even think, came up for a vote. Looked like it was totally dead in the water. But now we have the 3.0 version, and it passed the House. Now, I'm going to tell you what's in the bill, and buckle up because it's not pretty. So about 90% of this bill is the same as the original proposal, and I'm going to remind you what those provisions are as well as give you the new ones. So we have reporter Laurel Raymond here gives us the details. She says the CBO estimation of the first iteration of the bill projected that it would cause 24 million people to lose their health insurance in the next 10 years. The White House's own projection was even harsher, estimating a drop in overall coverage to the tune of 26 million. All right, so let me just pause and explain that a little bit. When we talk about the CBO, it's nonpartisan. So, this is the CBO, it's a group that or an agency that has been cited by Republicans whenever they have something to say that might be, might portray a Democratic piece of legislation in a negative light. So it's a nonpartisan group. They say, hey, 24 million people are going to lose their health insurance under the first version of the bill. The White House's own estimates were, no, actually it's going to be 26 million. So the White House's was worse. And then get this. This was the first version of the bill. Under the version of the bill that actually passed, They made it more right-wing and more draconian to appease the so-called Freedom Caucus, which is the Tea Partiers, and they didn't even allow the CBO to do a full breakdown of the new bill before they passed it. And that was on purpose, because they knew, ooh, if the CBO gets their hands on this and they give us the facts on it, it's going to be ugly. So let's hurry up and pass it before we have facts on it, because if we have the facts on it, it'll just get hammered in the media, and it'll be hammered by the opposition party, and it'll be basically untenable, and you can't vote for it lest you be an idiot who, you know, wants your constituents to feel the pain. So just let's not even have a CBO estimate. Let's not get final numbers. Let's just vote on it right now. And again, the newer version of the bill is going to have even more people uninsured than the first version of the bill. Absolutely incredible. All right, let's continue. Since then, the legislation has been tweaked to allow states to opt out of Obamacare's essential health benefits mandate, which requires health plans to cover some pretty basic services, things like hospitalizations, emergency room visits, prescriptions, and maternity care. The revised bill also allows states to opt out of protections for people with pre-existing conditions. About half of Americans could thereby be excluded from those protections. The definition of pre-existing conditions includes gender-based factors such as postpartum depression and even being a survivor of rape or domestic abuse, or domestic violence, they say. So now they could opt out of protections for pre-existing conditions. By the way, nice compromise, guys, because the so-called moderate Republicans, which basically just means Republicans who are elected in otherwise blue states and sometimes blue districts, they know, like, okay, I can't vote for this Obamacare repeal because then people in my district are going to lose their health care and I'm going to be voted out instantly. So at the very least, they would argue, well, okay, look, we're with you on a lot of the draconian shit, but don't get rid of the protections for pre-existing conditions. There's no way I could spin that to my constituents to get reelected. And the Tea Partiers said, no, we're going to get rid of every word of Obamacare, including the protections for pre-existing conditions. So they came up with a compromise. Allow states to opt out of protections for people with pre-existing conditions. So in other words, what will happen is every red state in the country will say, yeah, we don't have protections for people with pre-existing conditions. Some blue states will probably say that as well. And you'll only have, like, the bluest states that say, yeah, no, we still have the protection for people with pre-existing conditions. But look at what's defined as a pre-existing condition. They say if you've been raped, yeah, if an insurance company can reject you because of pre-existing conditions. And by the way, even if they didn't go in this direction, if they still had the protections for people with pre-existing conditions, under the Republican bill, it wasn't even really protections because they would allow the health insurance companies to jack up your prices, your premiums, massively so that it would basically make it unaffordable. So it's, in effect, having a ban on protections for people with pre-existing conditions without even having it. Well, now they went as far as to say, yeah, no, you can opt out of that. Think about how disconnected this is from what the American people want. Because guess what? Yes, when you poll people about Obamacare, it's about 50% support, which, okay, you could argue, come on, it's got to be higher. I hear you. But when you go provision by provision in Obamacare, the only one people don't like is the individual mandate. Every other one is massively popular. Close the Medicare donut hole, super popular. Allow kids to stay on their parents' health insurance until they're 26 years old, super popular. It used to be lower than that. Protection for pre-existing conditions, super popular. Expansion of Medicaid, super popular. So they're just taking a fucking sledgehammer to it, and the American people don't support any of these provisions when you get into the details. Okay, more. Under Trump Care, states could opt out of Obamacare's current provisions and get a waiver instead. In that case, people with pre-existing conditions, whoever had a gap in their health insurance coverage, could then be charged exorbitant rates by insurers or kicked into high-risk pools. All right, now let me give you info on the high-risk pools. Republicans have touted such high-risk pools as protection for people with pre-existing conditions, but in the past, such pools often offered long waiting lists for coverage, skimpy plans, and sky-high costs. To pass Trump Care, Republicans claimed then an extra $8 billion they added to cover high-risk pools would prevent this from being the case. However, that number falls far short of the $200 billion a Center for American Progress analysis estimated would be required. So what that means is if you want to expand the high-risk pools, to protect people with those pre-existing conditions who basically won't get covered. You need about $200 billion to get that done. And they're like, nah, we'll give you $8 billion. What? All right, they say, according to Kaiser Family Foundation Senior Vice President Larry Levitt, the $8 billion might cover a few hundred thousand high-risk enrollees out of millions who might need it. That's incredible. Now, I get it. Center for American Progress is, you know, left-leaning for sure. So you could say, I don't believe that number. I don't believe that the high-risk pools need $200 billion. But even if you cut that in half and say they need $100 billion, they're only giving $8 billion. This is out of this world irresponsible and immoral and unethical and flat out stupid, this plan. All right, so now let's sum it up. What does all of this mean? Well, under TrumpCare 3.0, the uninsured rate is going to go from 10%, which is what it would be under Obamacare, to about 19%. So it nearly doubles the uninsured rate. We're also going to have, to give you the raw number here, it would be about 53 million people uninsured. There's going to be an $880 billion cut to Medicaid over the next decade. And this is when, remember, Trump promised repeatedly on the campaign trail he wasn't going to cut it. He's cutting it to the tune of $880 billion over a decade. And also, here's probably the most important part, $594 billion in tax cuts for the rich. In fact, everybody in the top 0.1% is going to get $200,000 more in their bank account each year. So this is class warfare, and it's a massive redistribution of wealth from the middle class and the poor to the top 1%, and specifically top 0.1%. That's what this bill is. I'm not sure I've ever seen a piece of legislation worse than this. And you know who agrees with me? The American people. You know what this the first version of Trump Care was polling at? 17%. And remember, this new version, about 90% the same, identical. And the only thing they changed were things that made it worse. So they changed stuff specifically when it comes to pre-existing conditions and gave people less protection. And oh yeah, by the way, as part of this bill, Planned Parenthood is also defunded. You know, the Democrats were, when this passed, and it passed razor-thin margin, passed with 217 votes, the Democrats were singing, na, 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 hey, 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 goodbye. And my first reaction to that was like, come on, you're like trivializing a really horrific moment where millions of people are going to lose their health care. And yes, people will die as a result of this. But then thinking back on it, it's like, yeah, it's a little flippant of the Democrats to say that. But that's totally true. The Republicans who voted for this? Forget it. Forget it. They're jokes, man. This whole fucking bill is just crafted as a giant giveaway to the rich, a redistribution to the rich, and, you know, a heist for the health insurance companies. And remember, Obamacare was already a right-wing piece of legislation. Richard Nixon proposed an individual mandate system, which is what Obamacare is. Bob Dole proposed it. Newt Gingrich and Chuck Grassley supported it. Mitt Romney put it into place in Massachusetts when he was governor. So this is a right-wing bill through and through. In fact, the Heritage Foundation wrote policy papers in support of individual mandate systems like Obamacare, and they said at the time, this is our answer to the Democratic proposal, which is single-payer, Medicare for all. So we already did a right-wing, watered-down reform that keeps the health insurance companies in control, the private, for-profit health insurance companies. And the Republicans have gotten so extreme that out of spite, because Obama, a Democrat, passed their bill, they go, we hate it now, we're going to get rid of our own bill, and put in its place a ragtag bill that's slapped together at the last minute. That, guys, they don't even care about the outcomes. That's the point. Like, they're doing this reform to the healthcare system, but everything that would be a measure of the healthcare system and how good it is objectively worse. You have more people, you have fewer people, I should say, with insurance, so more people who aren't covered. You have prices that are going to go up. That's another aspect of this. The people who need care the most and who struggle the most to afford it, their prices shoot up under this. So it's basically like a reverse reform. It's going in the wrong direction. Paul Ryan, remember when he gave the speech, you know, in front of a bunch of reporters, and he's showing all these graphs because he's viewed as an intellectual, the biggest faux intellectual on the planet. He read a few Ayn Rand books and thinks he's a genius. And he's talking about how, you know, under Obamacare, you have these young, healthy people paying in, and they're paying for the older, sick people. It's crazy. That's insurance, you idiot. What the fuck do you expect to happen? Yes, that's the whole point of insurance. Doesn't get it, doesn't care. This is a worst-case scenario bill. Now, here's the good news. The good news is it appears to be dead on arrival in the House. They're going to need 60 votes to pass it. Now, when I tweeted that yesterday, that, oh, filibuster the shit out of this bill, a lot of people responded to me and were like, but filibuster is dead. That's not true. The filibuster is only dead at the moment for cabinet appointments, so they just need a simple majority for cabinet appointments, and Supreme Court picks. They recently nuked the 60-vote threshold for picks for the Supreme Court. For this, you can still do a filibuster. Now, is there a chance they go nuclear again? Yes. If they do that, I mean, it is such an unmitigated disaster for the country that I honestly wouldn't even know how to put it into words, wouldn't even know how to begin to break it down. Because if they were to make it a simple majority for this and it passes, oh, God, the amount of damage this does to regular people, you know, they would basically be shoving a bill down our throats with a 17% approval rating, wrecking the U.S. healthcare system in the process. The healthcare system, which already is not good, and also signing their death warrant, the Republicans, because that would be so colossally unpopular that there would be a left-wing wave in the country, the likes of which I don't know if we've ever seen. And don't get too crazy here with the, you know, jujitsu thinking and like, well, what if we make everything really bad in order to make it better? Because no, the amount of damage and collateral damage and that happens in the process is unacceptable. We need to make that progressive wave happen without allowing the worst case scenario to happen. We can't be in favor of the worst case scenario to happen. We got to have the progressive wave and be able to block this. So it's amazing to me that it appears like one of the two major political parties doesn't even really pretend to care about having positive outcomes with their legislation. That's the only thing I could take away from this. That's it. There's no other, like, anybody who knows the details of this, the only thing you could take away from it is, oh, like, that wasn't even a consideration. Like, how will this affect people? Now, the Democrats are horrible, and they're sellouts as well. But it's just to a lesser degree, and there's at least fucking provisions sprinkled in, even under shitty healthcare the Democrats propose, like Obamacare, where, like, okay, yes, those definitely help people. Certain provisions are definitely positive. Others are just a sellout and a giveaway to the health insurance companies, but Obamacare was a step in the right direction. This is the utter destruction of the U.S. healthcare system. So I would fight tooth and nail. I would fight viciously to stop this. And I wouldn't rest until I was positive it is completely and utterly dead, because it's one of the worst pieces of legislation I think I've ever seen. Okay. Okay, okay, okay. All right, let me give you one more, and then we'll take our first break. Trump Care. And the Australian Prime Minister. You're thinking, how the fuck does this tie in? Well, you're about to find out. So after TrumpCare passed the House yesterday, Donald Trump had a scheduled meeting, some event with the Australian Prime Minister. And listen to what he said.
Maybe even better. It's a very good bill right now. The premiums are going to come down very substantially. The deductibles are going to come down. It's going to be fantastic health care. Right now, Obamacare is failing. We have a failing health care. I shouldn't say this to our great gentleman and my friend from Australia, because you have better health care than we do.
They do have universal health care. I know. I thought you would.
Okay. Wait a minute. Wait a minute, Chris. All right. The president has just said it. That's great. Let's take a look at the Australian health care system. And let's move. Maybe once they look at the Canadian health system or systems throughout Europe. Thank you, Mr. President. Let us move to a Medicare for all system that does what every other major country on earth does, guarantee health care to all people at a fraction of the cost per capita that we spend. Thank you, Mr. President.
Donald Trump has now praised health care in Canada, single-payer system, Scotland, single-payer system, and Australia. Single-payer system. He's on the record now at least six times. I've given you the exact quotes, and some of them are just so fucking straightforward that it's like I said it or Bernie Sanders said it, where he's like, yes, we should do a single-payer system. So here you have a guy, he's giving you all these opportunities for the Democrats, for them to do exactly what Bernie just did right there, which is, you can go to the floor of the House, go to the floor of the Senate, have all of his quotes laid out there, and just bludgeon him over the head with them and do it every night and make news all the time and talk about how, I guess, President Trump is a liar. Now, he can basically undo the fact that he's a liar and stick to his guns and work with us to implement a Medicare for All system, or he can just be a liar and he can do the exact opposite of a Medicare for All system, with this ridiculous bill which keeps the private, for-profit, rapacious health insurance companies in control. Look, the reality is so many of the Democrats in the Senate don't support a Medicare for All bill, and 104 Democrats in the House do. But there's still a lot of Democrats in the House that don't support Medicare for All. The overwhelming majority of the Democrats, in fact, I think Bernie's the only one in the Senate that does support Medicare for All, or at least at this point, maybe has three or four people sign onto it that I haven't seen yet. But that's why they're not doing the effective strategy, the correct strategy, because many of them don't believe in it. Well, now is the fucking time, man. The guy just passed through the House his shitty health care bill, and he turns around and praises single-payer health care. What are you doing? Attack, 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 attack. That's incoherent. Tell him, look, yes, we agree with you. We agree with you when you say the thing you say most often, which is, yes, single payer is the best. And then, by the way, I also, Trump is amazing to me because you heard it at the beginning there. He just says stuff. Like he's, you know, the premiums are going to come down, the deductibles are going to come down, talking about under this bill, the TrumpCare 3.0 bill. No, they're not. That's nowhere near true. There's not a single analysis of the bill by anybody, even the most right-wing fucking kind outlet that there is that says, yeah, the prices are going to come down. Nobody said that. Nobody says. They didn't even allow the CBO to crunch the numbers on the new one because they knew it would be shitty. They passed it before the CBO got to release the final numbers on it. So, but that clip says everything about Trump right there, because the first part when he's like, deductibles are going to come down, you know, premiums are going to come down, he says it so confidently, he has no fucking idea if that's true. And in fact, all the evidence is the opposite. Damn, he's just so shameless, man. He says anything. So, but what you need to do is isolate the at least six times where he said, I'm for single payer, bludgeon him over the head with that, and make him bend to your will. And this gives you an opportunity also to raise consciousness and awareness about single payer. 60% of the American people already support it. Hammer away, make it 70%, make it 80%, and then make it inevitable that we eventually get a single-payer system, because the grassroots is rising up and forcing the politicians to get to that point. So, but there you have it. Donald, he can't help himself, man. All the fucking time, he can't help himself. Contradicting himself, lying, but you have to isolate the moments where he says stuff like that, where it's like, yeah, your system's better, and it's free, it's universal, it's single payer. Isolate that and go to work. That's your job. Start doing it. Okay. Quick break. When we come back, we have more on healthcare. Shock, shock. And when we're done with healthcare, which we still have a few more, Hillary Clinton is starting a new political group. And, man, man, am I going to go off on that, because, Jesus Christ, the... When you hear what the core of it is and why she's even doing it, you're going to hate her even more than you already do. Stay right there. We'll be right back.
Thank you. left you with the left, the left. I feel like I'm the last real nigga left, the left. It's like I'm on an island by myself, the left. Please don't make me slap you with the left, the left.
Son of a bitch. All right, we're back, y'all. All right, let's go to an epic beatdown. Ali Velshi of MSNBC spoke to former Congressman Joe Walsh about health care, and this was bizarre, and this was ugly. So Ali's going to hit him with a bunch of facts, and Joe Walsh's responses, I mean, it's like he's not even trying to make sense. So, and note the main argument he keeps coming back to as to why he doesn't think the U.S. can have single-payer health care. Let's watch.
Some figures. I'll read them to you because I know you probably can't see them there, but let's just talk about health care spending per person in the United States versus other countries, right? The average of all developed countries, I've used OECD countries, this is from 2015, is $3,814 per person. This is all spending. This is insurance. This is what you pay out of pocket, everything, what the government pays. In the United States, that number is $9,451 a person. Strikes me, Joe, as a conservative and a Republican, that's the problem right there.
Bingo. And the reason, Ellie, that's the case is because we don't have a real market for health care. Health care is expensive because somebody else is paying for it for most of us. Your employer, government, or the insurance company.
Right.
Unless we grow up and most of us take care of our day-to-day health care expenses, this isn't going to change.
Okay.
So, government should always be there for the needy, but the rest of us have got to assume more of these costs.
Let me give you another example. I'm going to rank health care outcomes by country, right? Again, same thing. OECD countries. Let's put that up, and we can discuss this. Number one, of all these OECD countries, all these developed countries in the world, Britain is number one, Switzerland's number two, Sweden's number three. These are 11 countries. The United States is dead last. Now, you know what the other 10 countries have in common? There's no market-based health care. There's universal health care in all of those countries. So, Mike, I hear what you're saying, and I'm a business guy, Joe. I generally think business can do things better than government. But in this case, there isn't a single example in the world of a health care system that runs in a free market.
Ellie, you can't compare the rest of the world to us. They do not have the big, diverse populations that we have. They do not have the inner-city populations that we have.
I'm going to show you the last one. U.S. performance rankings in terms of actual quality of care. Quality of care, the U.S. comes out 5th out of 11. Access to health care, 9th out of 11. Efficiency, equality, and living healthy lives, 11 out of 11. Joe, there's nowhere we succeed. This is the best country in the world with the biggest economy. We just don't get it right anywhere on health care.
But we have the highest quality of care, which is why people come here when they really need high quality
care. Very few people come to America. Very few people come to America for health care.
But again, the problem is
rich people come to America for health care.
For the best quality of care in the world, Allie. Absolutely. The problem is we have Medicaid that's broke, Medicare that's broke, Social Security that's broke, and now we've just got another entitlement called Obamacare that will bankrupt
this
country.
So how do I convince you that for all those outcomes, I mean, Joe Walsh, if you want to live a healthier life, better access to health care, you want to live longer than anybody in developed countries, and yet I've proven to you that 10 out of 11 countries do it better than America, but you won't do it.
I love you, my friend, but you cannot. Sweden does not have our inner city population. Norway, these countries do not have. You're talking about countries the size of India with homogeneous populations, Ellie. You can't compare them to what we have.
Canada, though. That's not Canada.
Oh,
Canada's as multicultural as the United States, if not more, with a 15% corporate tax rate and lower personal income tax rates than in the United States. So even the argument about I don't want to pay more taxes. You go to Toronto, you won't pay more taxes, and your health care is free.
Not at all. You'll pay more taxes there, and the quality of care isn't as good.
You 100% won't pay more taxes
Allie,
there,
you'll
Joe.
Wait longer. You will
just
wait
not gonna
much
happen.
Longer for
You're
care.
You're in Chicago. You know how close you are to Canada? Go over there. You will not pay higher taxes.
You will die in America if you're on Medicaid. That's our problem.
That was one of the most infuriating things I've ever watched. It's like Joe Walsh is incapable of even responding to the points that he's making. He just goes right to, well, you know, Allie, what we got to do is you got this problems in this country. Medicare, Medicaid's going broke. Medicaid's really bad. Now we got another entitlement called Obamacare. It's going to bankrupt this country. You know, the wait lines, wait lists, it's not good. And notice the argument he made repeatedly, I think at least two times, maybe three times there, was, well, you can't compare us to those other nations because they have homogeneous populations. We have diverse populations. They don't have the inner city problem that we have here. You've heard that argument before, haven't you? Think about it. Why would that matter? Why does that matter? Why does that matter to a guy like Joe Walsh? What? Because to him, he thinks, well, I mean, come on, let's be serious. When you have diversity, when you don't have a homogeneous society, when you have those inner cities, we got dark-skinned people running around here, and they're not the same as the light-skinned people, so we can't have single-payer health care. Darkies will ruin the whole thing. How can somebody make that argument and think it's serious? Like, look, you can either call Joe Walsh a racist or just say he's fallen for the logic of the racist. There's no other, like, when you make that argument, there's no other interpretation of it. So, and Ali Velshi says, well, actually, no, Canada has single-payer health care and they do not have a homogeneous population, so you're wrong. Canada has single-payer health care, and they have better outcomes, better cost, higher quality care than we do. And they're not homogeneous, so you're incorrect. He's like, yeah, but, we got diversity in the inner cities here. And, God, it's so sad to watch that, man. And he keeps giving, like, information and data on, oh, here, we're ranked dead last in terms of the modern nations. How you like them apples? And he just keeps firing back with incoherent nonsense. How do you, like, you can't convince a guy like Joel Walsh with information. Because he's not listening to you. It doesn't sink in. He doesn't care about the numbers. It's just like he reflexively goes back to his talking points. You know, hey, we're too diverse to have health care. We're too diverse to do it, even though it works everywhere else in the world, it won't work here, and the problem is we don't have a market. All we have is a market for healthcare here. We have private, for-profit, rapacious health insurance companies. By the way, that's the problem right there, and Joe Walsh's solution is more of the problem. The problem is we have unnecessary middlemen, rapacious, for-profit, private insurance companies that take their cut unnecessarily. That jacks up the prices. A single-payer healthcare system just means the government is the single insurer, so everybody's insured through the government. That's all that means. And there's no profit margin. They don't need to take a cut, which is why other countries cover everybody and pay less for it. So it's just amazing. And even the argument, like the last refuge of the idiot science denier is what it is for people who don't believe in single-payer healthcare, is wait lines. Except we also have wait lines. And the way their wait lines are for elective procedures, in other words, ones that are not vital and necessary to happen immediately. If you need care immediately, you're going to get it. For elective procedures, yes, you might have to wait a little bit. For here in the U.S., we also have wait lines, and it goes based off of the size of your wallet. So the richer you are, the more likely you are to get care right away. If you're poor and you need the surgery, maybe you don't get it right away because you're poor. So our wait line is based on the size of your wallet. Their wait lines are based on how much you need the care. Gee, I wonder which one is better. And also, that was another one of his last points was, if we have best care in the world, it's why people come here. Actually, no, he just showed you the numbers. We have one of the worst in terms of quality of care. But Joe Walsh is like, yeah, but that's why people come here, though, so we have the best care. No, we don't. You keep saying we have the best. He just showed you we're not the fucking best. He showed you an empirical study, and you keep rejecting it. But what Joe Walsh is referring to is, like, Saudi princes come here, like billionaires. Yeah, because they're fucking billionaires. Only the richest of the rich get the best care. Half this country makes $30,000 a year or less. So what, you want 95%, 99% of Americans to be fucked with not good care? But so Saudi princes can come here and they can get good care? Incoherent babble. Joe Walsh is a buffoon. He's a clown. Ali Velshi, he also couldn't have been nicer about the facts he was presenting. He kept giving him like, look, no, I'm a business guy. I understand where you're coming from. This is not a partisan thing. I'm just here to say, here are the facts. And Joel was like, anyway, let me give you some more dumbass talking points in my fake conservative radio host voice. Which, by the way, he actually does have or did, I don't know if he still does, conservative radio show. You can tell by how he talks. He, like, put on the persona. Let me give you some incoherent talking points here after you schooled my punk ass and talk about how diversity sucks. Thanks, Joe. You were a great, addition to the conversation here. You gave us a lot of information. Okay, next. Now we go to Charles Krauthammer. Actually, you know what? I'm going to hold off on the Crowdy. Crowdy can wait because we got so many fucking healthcare stories that I'm just going to do one more and then we'll move on. The Washington Times is a far right-wing publication, and they published, honestly, the worst article I've ever read this week. I'm not kidding. So Jimmy Kimmel gave an emotional monologue the other night where he explains how his kid was born with a heart condition, and of course the doctor saved him. But if he was poor, he wouldn't have been able to afford the surgery. And, that weighed on his mind. And he's like, that's fucked up, man. Like, if I wasn't Jimmy Kimmel and I was Jimmy Kimmler, the kid would have been screwed, or I would have had to gone bankrupt to pay for the kid's surgery. So he basically took this personal story, he teared up, and he was calling for increased funding for healthcare. And he also went as far as to say, look, this isn't even a partisan issue. I want solidarity and love and brotherhood among Americans, where certain things are off the table, and one of them we say is, we're going to make sure you're all right if you get sick. So it's a really touching moment. But Charles Hurt, that's his real name, Hurt, appropriate last name, as you'll see in a second, of the Washington Times, he had something to say about this. Look at the title of his piece. Shut up, Jimmy Kimmel, you elitist creep. I can't get over the irony of that, man. Jimmy Kimmel is the elitist creep? Your headline would show that you are the elitist creep. Jimmy Kimmel's like, yeah, man, we should all pitch in and help out each other. Wouldn't that be great? Just like basic, fundamental human decency and this touching story from my personal life about my kid being sick leads me to come out here and feel compelled to tell everybody about this. Elitist creep, you want to help people. Puh. No, an elitist creep would be somebody who looks down their nose at others and is condescending and is like, please, I only care about myself. What an idiot this guy is. Okay, but I just gave you the title. Let's dive into the article. He says, this is why America hates Hollywood. Yeah, that's why America hates Hollywood. Late-night funny man Jimmy Kimmel delivered a heart-wrenching monologue Monday night that every mother and every father could relate to. In the emotion-drunk moments last month, after the birth of their son, still in the hospital room surrounded by nurses and euphoric family, he and his wife watched their boy turn blue and got the terrifying news that something was wrong with his heart, or lungs, or both. Mr. Kimmel called it the longest 3 hours of my life. As more nurses and doctors and machines crowded into the room, and his little infant boy was cut open for the emergency open-heart surgery, which, thank the Lord, was successful. Understandably, Mr. Kimmel could not get through the story without breaking down in tears throughout the telling. And then his monologue went horribly awry. Here was this moment highlighting the preciousness of life, the heroism of nurses, the unmatched expertise of surgeons, and the magical power of family. And what is the point of it all for Jimmy Kimmel? Politics. Grubby, dirty politics. I want to say one other thing, Mr. Kimmel said, after thanking all the people who just saved his baby son's life, spared his family from a lifelong misery, and supported them all through the whole traumatic ordeal. President Trump last month proposed a $6 billion cut in funding to the National Institute of Health, the funny man continued. And thank God our congressman made a deal last night to not go along with that. It was suddenly as if instead of bringing forth into life an exquisite bundle of joy, Mr. Kimmel had handed a stupid golden statue, had been handed a stupid golden statue, and as if at the Oscars, the dirty, self-absorbed, narcissistic exhibitionist could not help himself but step into the Klieg lights and start blubbering about politics. All right, let me pause for a second. Everything is politics. Everything is politics. So what do you mean, like, oh, he started talking politics? When you wake up in the morning and take your medication, Charles Hurt, is that a name, Charles Hurt? I think it's whatever. Mr. Hurt. You know that's politics, right? Because those pills you took were approved by the FDA. There are regulations to make sure that those pills are safe. When you have your breakfast cereal, there are laws about how that milk is made, how it's regulated. When you drive on the road, that's politics. There's a speed limit. The speed limit was, you know, debated. The infrastructure was paid for by tax dollars. Everything about every aspect of life is politics, which is one of the main reasons why I'm really interested in politics, because it's all-encompassing. It's how we organize a society, what rules there are, what we fund, what we don't fund, what we leave to the private market, what we leave for the public sector. So for him to use that, he thinks it's like a Trump card argument against what Jimmy Kimmel is saying, like, there he goes again, politics. Not only does that mean nothing, that means less than nothing. You're not saying anything. It's like you're arguing, ah, Jimmy Kimmel, there he goes again, talking about things. Why do you talk about things, Jimmy? Your argument means nothing. Politics, there it is, politics. As if he can, like, spike the fucking football into a victory lap. I just accused him of doing politics, so aren't I great? And by the way, this idiot's even dumb enough to bring up the specific fact that Jimmy Kimmel raised. Jimmy Kimmel was like, hey, isn't it fucked up that Trump wanted to cut the NIH by 18%? Cut it $6 billion worth? And isn't it great that the congressman in the last-minute budget deal actually increased funding for the NIH slightly, thereby saving scientific research? And yes, kids, they're about 40% of the people who are benefited by the research the NIH does are children. So the guy brings up the fact that Trump wanted to cut it $6 billion, and that would have hurt kids. And the guy's like, oh, there you go again, politics. Yeah, but those are facts, you idiot. You got to actually rebut the argument. You can't just have this condescending snark like, nah, there he goes again, politics, nah. Yeah, but why don't you address the argument? He doesn't, because he can't. How are you going to address the argument? All right, let me give you more. They actually increased funding by $2 billion, and I applaud them for doing that because more than 40% of the people, this is what I just told you, who would have been affected by those cuts to the National Institute of Health are children. And it would have a major impact on a lot of great places, including the Children's Hospital in Los Angeles, he sobbed, which is so unbelievably sad to me. After a slobbering wet kiss to federal bureaucracy, Mr. Kimmel then went squealing on about Obamacare and how insurance companies, the government, and your neighbors should all be forced to pay for everybody else's health care. Easy thing to say for a gazillionaire from Hollywood. I mean, really, Jimmy, does your newborn child not mean more to you than petty politics? How you look at the miracle of your child and think, partisan politics? That is not to say he didn't also lie and claim to be above partisan politics, even as he was pushing exactly that. Quote, let's stop this nonsense, he said. This isn't football. There are no teams. We are the team. It's the United States. Don't let their partisan squabbles divide us on something every decent person wants. Yes, that's right. He just had a kid, and the kid nearly died, and he wants you to know that if you are not for bloated federal bureaucracy, socialized medicine, higher taxes, and tons of more debt piled onto your grandchildren, then you are not a decent person. Actually, Jim, if you were a decent person, you would shut your fat trap about partisan politics and go care for your kid who just nearly died, you elitist creep. Jimmy Kimmel is pointing out the fact that his kid would be dead if it wasn't for the NIH funding, specifically the hospital where his kid was taken care of. And he's saying, I want everybody to have the quality health care that I had, and that requires funding. And he's even saying, what I interpreted Kimmel as saying is, like, look, man, if you have to raise my taxes to pay for it, raise my taxes. But this guy, he's, like, making it seem like Kimmel's doing this, saying something that's, like, against the average guy. No, he's helping the average guy. He's helping the little guy. you're not helping the little guy. And look at the gross framing he did here. I like how he goes, yeah, oh, that's what you're calling for, a bloated federal bureaucracy. You're taking this heart, this touching moment with your kid, this terrible incident, and you're using it to push for a bloated federal bureaucracy. Why are you framing it like that? You're framing it. He didn't frame it like that. You framed it like that. He didn't call for, you know, a bloated bureaucracy. Hey, let's give, you know, the NSA untold billions of dollars to spy on all of us. He didn't say that. Hey, let's waste $7 trillion in Iraq. He didn't say that. Hey, let's, you know, blow money on corporate welfare for ExxonMobil and have a real bloated bureaucracy. He didn't say that. He said specifically healthcare is what's important. And if we're prioritizing in a society, in a country, what we spend our money on, wouldn't healthcare be on the top of the list? But no, this idiot frames it as I want to give you the quote one more time because it's so gross. Socialized medicine, higher taxes, and tons more debt piled onto your grandchildren. Or what he's calling for is the U.S. should have a system like every other modern nation has where healthcare is off the table. You don't have to worry about it. I mean, notice you never hear these conservatives say, you know, oh, is that what you want? You want a bloated federal bureaucracy, socialized roads, higher taxes, and tons more debt piled on your kids? They don't say that about roads because in their mind and everybody's mind, it's grandfathered in. Like, well, of course we're going to use taxes for roads because to not do that would be fucking crazy. But with healthcare, they're still stuck in like the year 1806. And he's like, bloated bureaucracy, socialized medicine. Guys, the facts show, it's not me speaking, it's the World Health Organization speaking. It's there was another study done in 2014 which found that the U.S. is last among developed nations when it comes to healthcare because we have rapacious for-profit middlemen taking their cut. So they're price gouging us. The little guy gets screwed. How would we fix that? By doing a single-payer system, by taking tax money and using that to cover people and their healthcare expenses. And you don't even need to necessarily raise taxes. You could just cut out. If you cut the military budget, you could fund it. If you do, there's a million ways to fund it because we waste so much money on nonsense, whether it be corporate welfare, the military-industrial complex, or Wall Street bailouts, or whatever it is. You don't even need to raise taxes to get single-payer health care. But this guy is a sleazy liar who's insinuating, if not just flat-out saying, yeah, you know, Jimmy Kimmel, elitist creep. He wants to, like, pile debt onto your kids and have socialized medicine and higher taxes. You're adding all of that onto what he said. You're strawmanning him. He didn't say that. What he said very simply was, I want everybody to have the same care that my kid had, and it's fucked up that, you know, people treat this as a partisan issue. He's saying it shouldn't be a partisan issue. We should take care of our kids. We should have health care for people. And he gets called an elitist creep for doing it by an elitist creep. That's what you are, Mr. Hurt, and what a fucking appropriate last name that is. Mr. Hurt, because he can't wait to hurt people with his politics. Like, he acts like Jimmy Kimmel, boo, talking politics. Your argument is so stupid, it can be flipped back on you like that. Oh, there goes Hurt again, talking politics. Yeah. The problem isn't that you're talking politics. The problem is that your politics are idiotic. The problem is that your politics rejects every empirical study and objective fact about healthcare in the modern world that we know of. So spare me your condescending, pedantic, childish moralizing. You don't know what the fuck you're talking about on this issue, but you still have this smug approach to discussing a real serious issue and smearing a guy who's using a personal incident to call for the betterment of the healthcare system for everybody. You're the definition of an elitist creep. Oh, what, you want to, like, make lives better for people by, like, having good health care and not cutting the funding for that? Oh, how gross is that? Obviously, you're a real person and an average Joe and a regular guy if you don't want to fund health care and you want poor people and middle-class people to not have the same access to health care that you do. Worst article I've ever read. Don't think that's hyperbole. Okay. All right, let's go to Hillary Clinton. Politico is reporting on a new story involving Hillary Clinton, and Hillary is planning on getting back into politics in one of the worst ways imaginable. So let me tell you what they report here. 6 months after losing the presidential election, Hillary Clinton is ready to wade back into politics. The former Secretary of State is building a new political group to fund organizations working on the resistance to President Donald Trump's agenda. Spending recent weeks in Washington, New York City, and Chappaqua, New York, meeting with donors and potential groups to invest in and recruiting individuals for the group's board of directors, multiple people close to the two-time White House hopeful and people familiar with the group's planning told Politico. She's looking to launch the group, expected to be called Onward Together, a nod to her campaign slogan, Stronger Together, as soon as next week, they say. Clinton's spokesman declined to comment for this story. Let me just pause real fast to reflect on that name. After it became utterly apparent that one of the reasons she lost is that she had a messageless campaign. It was empty. It was vapid. It was vacuous. Because she would just spew the platitudes and the cliches. America's already great. Break down the barriers. Stronger together. She's setting up a group and calling it Onward Together. You want to talk about not learning the lesson of the previous election? Guys, only 25% about of her ads were focused on policy. And what's her approach now? Let's make a group that we're going to call Onward Together. Again, empty, vague, so that you don't, she wants to give you the impression, I'm for good things and against bad things, but you don't ever cite what those good things are, because you're not really for good things. Okay, let me continue. Clinton has been working with Dennis Chang, her campaign finance director, who was previously the Clinton Foundation's chief development officer, to bring donors into the fold. This is now the third reference to donors in this short article. The new organization is not expected to have a large staff, but will instead focus on sending money to other organizations at a time that Democratic donors are largely unsure about how they should spend their cash. What is that, the fourth reference? So short article, already had four references to donors. Did you guys notice any references to policy? You didn't, right? They didn't mention a single fucking policy. Because it's Hillary Clinton 101, put the cart before the horse. I'm launching this new group called Onward Together, and the whole point of it is to get donors together, raise big money, and then give it to resistance groups. You know what this really is? This is Hillary Clinton making sure the Democratic Party remains corporate. It remains a party that's beholden to Wall Street and Big Pharma and the insurance companies. And the military-industrial complex. That's what this is. The whole point of it is a donor network. They say, the staff's going to be small. Why? Because they don't need anybody. They're not going to do anything. They go to Wall Street, take the money, and then funnel the money to the so-called progressive groups that they know will do the bidding of Wall Street and the donors. This is a coup by Hillary Clinton, by the corporate Democrats, to try to make sure the Democratic Party remains corporate. Let me be crystal clear. They are the enemy. Now, by the way, if what they said here was true, like, oh, no, it's just about the resistance. It's just about being opposed to Donald Trump. Well, first of all, if it's just the resistance, well, then what are you for? You're just defining yourself as what you're against, but what are you for? They can't say what they're for because they're not for actual progressive values. But, okay, you know who's the best at resisting Trump? We are. Justice Democrats. Brand new Congress. Our revolution, the Democratic Socialists, the Greens. We're the first ones that are always fucking out there in the streets protesting, applying pressure to Congress people. We're the first ones. So are you going to, are you trying to give money to those groups? No, because you know that we won't do the bidding of the corporations. So we're cut out, you know, but you go to other groups. You go to groups that you know are going to be good little bitches to Wall Street, and they get all the money in the world. So that's what this is about, guys. The Clinton zombie is still trying to control Democratic politics. And if they win, you will have perpetual losses for the Democrats. They're already obliterated and decimated. From the 1980s and onward, we've had this neoliberal model of Democrat, which is a Wall Street party, a military-industrial complex party, a corporate party. And what are the results? The Republicans now hold the Senate, the House, most state legislatures, most governorships, and they have the presidency. So this neoliberal model failed. It's not a matter of interpretation. It's not a matter of opinion. It's a fact. It failed. If it didn't fail, we wouldn't be at this point. But now, in all of their hubris and arrogance, they say, nope, let's continue with the corporate money. But that's the fucking problem, Hillary. That's the problem. But they don't get it because it's like a fish in water. If you ask a fish, how's the water? They go, what the fuck do you mean, water? What does that mean? So you ask Hillary, how's the corruption? She's like, I don't even, what do you mean, corruption? This isn't fucking corrupt. We just raise money from donors and then we run our campaigns. And don't you want the most money possible? No, not if that money comes with strings attached. They just view that as par for the course. That's politics. You take some money from Wall Street, okay, you're for deregulation. You're for outsourcing jobs. Whatevs. I'll try to help people in other ways. But yeah, this is just what it is. No, that's not what it is. The only way for the Democrats to win is to embrace justice Democrats. You know what we say? You can't be a justice Democrat and take corporate money and take PAC money. You just can't. You just can't. Then you're not a justice Democrat, because that's how we know that you're serious and that you're going to represent your constituents and you're going to represent the people, is that you don't have donors who are not the people. So that's the most important thing. And furthermore, we are our platform. We show exactly what we're about. Hillary Clinton just goes to the donors and says, give us money. We're in the resistance. We're against Trump. Give us money. What does that mean? What are you for? Are you for Medicare for all? No. Are you for free college? No. Are you for making the minimum wage a living wage and tying it to inflation? No. Are you for ending the wars? No. Are you for a new deal and a climate change revolution, a climate revolution with green technology and renewable technology that gets us to 100% renewable? No. So you're not for anything. You're just, I'm against Trump. Aren't I a good person? Wall Street, give me money. Well, that is, if anything, giving Trump more power. Because the weaker the Democratic opposition is, the more corrupt they are, the more likely it is you keep Donald Trump in power. So the same fucking arguments that they used against Bernie people is the same argument that applies to them. Bernie people warned you, it's because we're against Trump that we need Bernie to be the nominee. You said, no, we need Hillary to be the nominee because Hillary's got the best chance of winning. Well, you were wrong, and now you're doubling down and tripling down, and you're hijacking the resistance. But your resistance is futile. Your resistance is weak. Because it's not a real resistance, because you're taking Wall Street money and you're keeping the Democratic Party a corrupt shell of its former self. Get the fuck out of the way. It's time for the Justice Democrats wave. You know exactly what we stand for. You know exactly what they stand for. You pick your side. Okay, next. Okay. Debbie Wasserman Schultz, let's go. Sorry if you hear there's quite a bit of rain going on. You could probably hear some of it because it's loud. Debbie Wasserman Schultz commented on Obama taking $400,000 for a speech to Wall Street, and it's every bit as cringeworthy as you'd expect.
Let me ask you, Hillary Clinton, as you know, spoke today. She, as we all are aware, was slammed during the campaign for taking millions of dollars from Wall Street for paid speeches, right? People saw it as hypocritical. People saw it as unfair for someone who said they were going to stand up to the banks. Now President Obama, though, is being criticized by some of your fellow Democrats for his decision to take $400,000 for a single speech to Wall Street. Here is what some Democrats are saying.
It's not a good idea. And, you know, I'm sorry that President Obama made that choice. I just think it is distasteful.
Well, I was troubled by that. One of the things I talk about in the book is the influence of money. I describe it as a snake that slithers through Washington, and that it shows up in so many different ways here in Washington.
Are they right? I mean, of all people to question whether or not their commitment to getting money out of politics, to really making sure that we restored integrity to the political finance process.
But he's talking specifically about banks, right?
Look, it is none of anyone's business what someone who is a member of the private sector decides to accept in terms of compensation. With all due respect to anyone who chooses to comment publicly on what Barack Obama, Hillary Clinton, or anyone earns as a member of the private sector, it's just like MYOB. It's none of your business.
That's every bit as grotesque and misleading and dumb as I expected it to be. Let's break it down. She says, of all people to question, getting money out of politics and how much they want to, make the system whole again, really it's going to be Obama? Yeah, Debbie, it's going to be Obama. You mentioned, Obama didn't want to get money out of politics? What did he do to get money out of politics? Gave a speech? Gave a few speeches? Said, I'm against Citizens United, which, by the way, shot a dead horse, because we already had the cancer of money in politics. It's been there since the fucking 1980s. What are you talking about, Debbie? Oh, really? You're going to question Obama? Yeah, we're going to question Obama. You're not. He didn't fucking do anything to get money out of politics. He did nothing on that front. Nothing. What do you mean? What are you saying? He gave a fucking speech or two? How stupid do you think we are, Debbie? Or how stupid are you that you don't realize it? No, but it's not. She agrees with Obama. It's clear she agrees with her. She agrees with Obama. She agrees with Hillary Clinton. Get over it. We're the best you got. So what? We're corrupt and we take Wall Street money. At least we're not the Republicans. You want to talk about a low bar, Debbie? Okay. So she plays stupid like, it's none of your business what a private citizen makes, in as compensation. MYOB, mind your own business. With such like scorn and disdain and condescension. Really, you don't get why this isn't the same as just a private citizen taking money? He was president of the United States. You know this is pay-to-play corruption, right? Well, Kyle, how can you say that? Oh, I don't know. Maybe the fact that he bailed out Wall Street. He bailed them out. And then they paid bonuses to the people who crashed their own companies. So he looked out for them. How about the fact that there was no prosecution? We had all the evidence of the world of systemic corruption and fraud on Wall Street as a business model at Goldman Sachs. But no, Obama took campaign contributions from them. So guess what? No prosecution. Not a single banker is in jail as a result of the subprime mortgage crisis and the Great Recession. How about the fact that there was massive deregulation? Now you say, well, come on, there was Dodd-Frank. Well, first of all, Dodd-Frank was super weak to begin with and had no teeth. So it was like, reform in name only for everybody to pat themselves on the back and say, oh, we fixed this. And then what happened after you passed the weak Wall Street regulation? In bill after bill afterwards, they would slip it into like agriculture bills. They would repeal provisions of Dodd-Frank. And guess what? Obama signed every one of them. So he was also on the side of doing deregulation. How about there was no Glass-Steagall brought back? You would think that when there was a crash directly related to the fact that we had gotten rid of Glass-Steagall, that the logical thing to do is to bring back Glass-Steagall. You think a lot of these people in the government didn't know that? They knew it, but they didn't care. They're paid to do the opposite. They're paid to not put it back in place because that would hurt the short-term profits of these companies that pay their campaign contributions. Or how about the fact that the banks are now bigger than before? Before they were too big to fail, now they're bigger than before. But Debbie Wasserman Schultz acts like, what do you mean? There's nothing wrong with this. It's just a private citizen taking money. It's not a symptom of a rotting, grotesque, corrupt system that the so-called progressive president who was supposed to crack down on the money changers, on the banksters, that he's totally sold out to them now. Why do you play us for fools? Why do you think we're idiots? We see right through you. By the way, Debbie Wasserman Schultz takes a tremendous amount of money from the payday loan industry, and then she blocked regulations that would have cracked down on the payday loan industry. So she's one of the most corrupt Democrats. So that's why she's apoplectic at the idea. What? You are besmirching Obama's great legacy? Of all the people to question. Yeah, we're fucking questioning him because we actually know what he did. We know what he did. We see the facts. We see what happened with policy. You're trying to do smoke and mirrors to say, look, he gave a few good speeches. He's better than Republicans. So, hey, shut up. Mind your own business. Mind your own business. JusticeDemocrats.com. I can't take these corporate Democrats anymore, man. I just can't take them. They're pathetic. They're ridiculous. They're liars. And they're so corrupt that I don't even think they understand that they are. If they're so far gone that they just view it as duh, it's part of the system. Yeah, whatever, we raise money from Wall Street. Shut the fuck up, you purity test bitch. That's how they view it. We need a wave to take them out. JusticeDemocrats.com, sign your name in support of the movement. Get involved, man. Donate, get involved, run, whatever it is, because we got to get rid of them, because they're the death of the Democratic Party. A lot of responsibility for Trump becoming president is laid right at the doorstep of Debbie Wasserman Schultz and people just like her. Okay, next. All right, this is one of the funniest stories of the day here. Bryce Reeves is a candidate for lieutenant governor in Virginia, and he released quite an ad for us here. Check it out.
This is the America Obama left behind. Terrorists living here, FBI investigating ISIS nationwide, frightening families. I'm Bryce Reeves. I helped pass anti-terrorism legislation here in Virginia, and as a former police officer, I'll support our cops and fight to defund sanctuary cities. I'm Bryce Reeves, candidate for lieutenant governor, and I sponsored this ad.
Okay, that was one of the best political ads I've ever seen in my life. The guy's a living parody. It's awesome. It's like, again, I always reference this movie, but I think it's so appropriate. He reminds me of Will Ferrell in the movie The Campaign. Like, he's got his hair exactly in the traditional, like, white man fucking style. And he's out there in his business shirt and his fleece, walking in a fucking suburban neighborhood. And the head is, ISIS robbing a house? Okay, so first of all, ISIS robbing? I'm pretty sure that's not their thing. Like, their thing is, we will implement a literal Sharia. And, you know, we will be terrorists, we will behead people. They're not, like, into fucking jacking a TV or some jewelry. That's not what they do. And so ISIS is robbing people, and they're also wearing camouflage in the suburbs. Not sure they get the point of camo. Camo is just supposed to mix in with the environment that you're in. They're not in an area where it's all trees. What? Who made this ad? Come on, man, that's great. Oh, God. And the kids are, like, playing soccer, and ISIS is just running around. Oh. Oh. And, look, man, I'm willing to bet there aren't many terrorists living in the suburbs of Virginia, but that's just me. You know, I'll just throw that out there. So, look, this is what happens when you have a party that has no ideas, you know. And I love the support our cops. I'll support our cops. Oh, thank you. Thank you. Because, you know, so many politicians are just, they run on a platform of like, let's abolish the police. Yeah. Let's get rid of them. We don't need the cops. Stinking cops. Not a single politician says that. Okay. I think, let's wrap up this segment. There's no reason to do any more here. He's just an epic goofball, man. Epic goofball. When your party has no ideas, this is what you do. You fear-monger, you know. You act like if you don't vote for me, you're with the terrorists, you're soft on ISIS. It's because you have nothing to say about things that actually affect people's lives. What percentage of people are affected, you know, by ISIS in Virginia versus the percentage of people who are affected by, I don't know, poverty, healthcare, taxes, you know, stuff that actually matters directly to them? You're not going to address any of the issues that matter. So let's just, you know, fear-monger about ISIS. Now, I get it, by the way. He's running for lieutenant governor, so it's a little bit different. But there's no context in which this ad is not stupid. I mean, I guess if he was running for lieutenant governor of Fallujah, it'd be a little different. But he's not. He's a goofball in fucking Virginia who has watched too much Fox News. Okay. Now we go to Bernie Sanders and his stuff on Palestine. Bernie spoke about Palestine recently. Dina Takruri of AJ Plus interviewed Bernie Sanders, and she gave him some pretty tough questions on the issue of Israel and Palestine.
Last week, you joined every single U.S. senator in signing a letter to the U.N. Secretary General saying that the institution is biased against Israel and effectively trying to shield it from criticism.
No. I don't accept that. Look, I didn't write that letter. I signed on to the letter. It's not a letter that I would have written. There are many problems with Israel, and I have been critical and will be critical of a lot of what Israel does. On the other hand, to see Israel attacked over and over again for human rights violations, which may be true, when you have countries like Saudi Arabia or Syria. Saudi Arabia, I'm not quite sure if women can even drive a car today, okay? So I think the thrust of that letter is not to say that Israel does not have human rights issues. It does. But to say how come it's only Israel when you have other countries where women are treated as third-class citizens, where in Egypt, I don't know how many thousands of people now lingering in jail. So that's the point of that. Not to defend Israel, but to say why only Israel. You want to talk about human rights? Let's talk about human rights.
Should the UN shield Israel from criticism?
No, of course not.
Okay. This letter also denounces the boycott, divestment, sanctions movement known as BDS. You, in your lifetime, are a longtime proponent of nonviolent protests.
Yep.
This, in the eyes of many Palestinians, is the effective way to get Israel to comply with international law and respect Palestinian human rights. Do you accept that?
No, I don't. I mean, look, I respect people will do what they want to do, but I think our job as a nation is to do everything humanly possible to bring Israel and the Palestinians and the entire Middle East to the degree that we can together. But no, I'm not a supporter of that.
Palestinians will say they've resisted violently, they get punished. They resist nonviolently with BDS, they're also punished. We're entering the 50th year in the occupation. June marks 50 years of occupation starting 1967. We know the occupation has no end in sight. We know that this is a government that doesn't plan on ending it. And talks have failed for a quarter century. What, if not BDS, is left for the Palestinians to do?
What must be done is that the United States of America must have a Middle East policy, which is even-handed, which does not simply supply endless amounts of money, military support to Israel, but which treats both sides with respect and dignity and does our best to bring them to the table. Okay.
Mm-hmm. With one more question, it's increasingly evident that hopes for a two-state solution are almost dead. At the same time, polls among Palestinians in the occupied West Bank and Gaza are showing that they're increasingly in favor of a one-state solution with equal rights for Israelis and Palestinians alike and equal citizenship. Is that something you believe could happen, or is that something you support?
No, I don't. I mean, I think if that happens, then that would be the end of the state of Israel. And I support Israel's right to exist.
Do you think a two-state solution is still viable?
Yes, I think if there is the political will to make it happen and if there is good faith on both sides, I do think it's possible, and I think there has not been good faith, certainly on this Israeli government, and I have my doubts about parts of the Palestinian leadership as well.
You can always tell when Bernie's getting mad because he starts to get, he gets a little red, and he'll end stuff with him. Okay, we'll wrap it up. I got it. Come on. I'm not comfortable here. Let me go. So let's break down some of his answers there. First of all, to the idea of, like, Israel is singled out by the UN. And then, by the way, the letter that Bernie signed on to heavily implied it's because of anti-Semitism. That's why. Well, first of all, they're not singled out by the UN. They pass token resolutions in the General Assembly about Israel. That's meaningless. That's nothing. The Security Council, where the votes matter, there was the one vote recently, and then the last one before that was 2002. So we've shown the, but the votes in the Security Council and who they go after, you know, when you see the actual countries they go after, Israel's nowhere in sight. So, I mean, it's just incorrect to say, oh, there's this anti-Israel bias. Oh, in the General Assembly, they're passing the token resolutions against Israel. And by the way, why are they even doing that? It's not because they're anti-Semitic. It's because Israel's doing an occupation. They're doing an illegal occupation, and they're stealing more and more Palestinian land, and they have an apartheid-like system set up, and it's in brazen violation of international law. So, I mean, like, what do you want them? Do you want them to just go easier on them? I don't, but it's the sickest, oldest trick in the book. Like, oh, it's anti-Semitic that you're going after them. Right, and it's Islamophobic to go after Saudi Arabia. You know, we've seen this play out before. We see how this game is played. And, you know, it's sexist to critique Hillary Clinton. It's a bastardization of identity politics, basically, to make that point. So no, Bernie, there's not, like, unfair crackdown on Israel. As Israel continues to take more and more Palestinian land as we speak, the concern is, like, oh, you're biased against Israel. Please, no, why isn't your outrage reserved for them fucking continuing to steal the land and continuing the occupation? I mean, Netanyahu, it's preposterous what he's doing. Okay, so, and then let's move on to BDS here. So BDS, Bernie's like, no, I don't support it. And what does he support instead? Oh, an even-handed U.S. policy. But an even-handed U.S. policy to what ends, Bernie? Like, what is, okay, so we don't have that right now. We don't have an even-handed U.S. policy. We haven't had an even-handed U.S. policy. So what do you want the Palestinians to do? Sit down and wait for a slightly more kind U.S. administration to come in? You know that's ridiculous, Bernie. You've been a supporter of nonviolent movements your whole life, like Dina pointed out. That is a nonviolent movement. So, yes, when the Palestinians react violently, they're denounced. And they should be, by the way. I don't support violence either. When they react nonviolently, though, they're still denounced, and they're called anti-Semites. But boycott, divestment, and sanctions, that's just economic pressure. That's all that is. That's the same strategy that worked in apartheid South Africa. We have a similar thing happening in Israel-Palestine, so they're doing nonviolent, basically economic sanctions, boycott, divestment, and sanctions. Guess what? That's led to a tremendous flee. Fucking technical problems. Okay, sorry about that. Wait for it, it's fixing. Come on. That's led to a tremendous flee of businesses from the West Bank. So it's working, and because it's working, that's why you're getting these panicked letters about how, this is an anti-Semitic movement, and it's not a good movement, and why are you doing this? Because they're scared of BDS, because it's working. So, and understand, the goalposts have been moved so far in the direction of the far right of Israeli politics that there is no real representation of Palestinians. So, for example, even fucking Hamas just came out with their new charter, and they said, okay, look, this isn't a religious fight. This is a political fight. You know, that's what this is focused on. Let's focus on politics here. Drop the religious stuff. We're not against all Jews. were against, you know, Zionists who take the land, and then they even accepted the 1967 borders. So you have even Hamas is like, okay, 1967 borders. And meanwhile, Israel is pretending that Yahweh is pretending. There's nobody who's a partner for peace on the other side. When even the extreme factions of the other side are like, all right, we give up, 67 borders. So it's just so fucking gross and misleading, and the way it's covered is just flat out incorrect. And you have even Bernie Sanders, who's like the best we have in the Senate, has fallen for the BS and is anti-BDS, and he's pretending there's this giant bias against Israel. So it's sad to watch. And the only point I agree with him on is the two-state versus one-state. There's like this new kind of groundswell of support for a one-state solution. And people go, well, the two-state solution is just not going to happen. Let's keep it real. The only thing that I think is less likely to happen than a two-state solution is a one-state solution. Because let's face it, man, there are such deep political and religious differences among Palestinians and Israelis that you're never going to get an Israeli government to agree, like, yeah, let's power share with Arabs. It's just not going to happen. Not going to happen. What's more likely to happen is, yes, you come up with some sort of a two-state deal, should be along the 67 borders, and, you know, should have independence and recognition for both. And sometimes good fences make for good neighbors. And I build a giant fucking wall between the Palestinian territories and the Israeli territories, and I call it a day. So, and I know that's not a very popular position, or I don't know, it's somewhat popular among people on the left, but there's this new growing movement that thinks the one state's the way to go. I don't think it's the way to go. I think it would lead to many more negative consequences. So that's the only one I agree with him on. He's wrong about the bias. He's wrong about BDS. And it's sad to see Bernie Sanders go down this path when, during the campaign, he had a bunch of shining moments, actually, on the issue of Israel-Palestine. Okay. All right, final story of the day real quick. Final story of the week, I should say. There's a pretty disturbing story from the International Business Times here. Hog farms spray pig urine, feces, into air around North Carolina's black communities. Wow. All right, so listen to this. Residents in North Carolina are fighting back against one of the state's most prominent hog farming, but the legislation may not be on their side. A group of lawmakers in the state passed House Bill 467, legislation that limits how much residents can collect in damages from hog farms. Hog farms in North Carolina dispose of pig feces and urine by spraying it untreated into the air where residents live. In response, nearly 500 of those residents, mostly African Americans from eastern North Carolina, brought a class action suit against Murphy Brown, the state's largest producer of hogs. The lawsuit has now made its way to federal court. Residents have said the process of waste disposal has caused health problems among those who live there. Not to mention the resulting smell limits their ability to be outside. The urine and feces produce chemicals like methane and ammonia, which smell akin to rotten eggs. Naeem Mohammed, organizing co-director for the North Carolina Environmental Justice Network, told Democracy Now!, and it's not just in the air. Quote, people have been forced off their wells because they were seeing remnants of the waste in their well waters by the coloring and odors coming out of their well water, Mohammed said. Residents said the odors caused immediate headaches, gag, and other health problems, and said they couldn't even open their windows. Okay, I've never seen a clearer example of just flat-out less concern for poor communities and communities of color. Yeah, dispose it and get rid of it over there in that neighborhood. You know what this reminded me of? It reminded me of, I think it was actually Rex Tillerson, who's now the Secretary of State. He was ExxonMobil CEO. He opposed fracking near his land that he owned, near his property. But he fights viciously when poor communities try to not have fracking and ban fracking around them. So he's for fracking if it's around poor people. He's against fracking if it's around him. How fucking convenient. Meanwhile, he makes these arguments like, there's nothing wrong with fracking. I'd have it by me. I'm fine with that. I don't know what he's talking about. Okay, I'm against it by me. Because it poisons the water wells and has all these problems. Well, there's another example. It's a similar kind of thing. You take poor communities, communities of color, and say, ah, fuck it, you know, whatever. Get rid of the pig urine and feces and spray it in the air by them. Untreated. And what's the main point here? Man, I've never seen a clear example of regulation. That's all that's fucking needed, man. That's all you need. You need regulations as to how to dispose of it, how to treat it, how to make it safe. You know, like, how would the fucking libertarians respond to this? How would they respond to this? They're like, yeah, no, it's cool. You know, free market. Market takes care of itself. Well, here it is. Here's the company deciding what they want to do with the pig urine and feces, and it's basically spray it in black communities and poor communities. So, no, not okay. And, you know, I hope that all the facts come out here, and I hope they get basic regulation, and I hope there's some restitution for all the people who are negatively affected by this, because I'm sure there are health problems associated with, and if it gets in your water, that's a, man, is that a horrible situation to be in. So, America, 2017. Pig urine and feces sprayed on poor people. Sums it up pretty well. Okay. All right, guys, out of time. I love y'all, and I will see you back here on Monday. Everybody, enjoy your weekend.